Accession number 10165, reel number 30.
Martin McLean, reel 30. You were telling me about the stores you thought might be in the garden at Roundtree Road, Bridlington.
Well, on handing over, when we moved out of the area, another battalion took over. And obviously you get them to check the ammunition and take them over. You hand them over piece by piece, like two boxes of grenades, three-inch mortar stuff. And we had in there Molotov cocktails, another separate pit. Molotov cocktails was a devisation whereby they had some phosphorus and petrol in a bottle with a little fuse on the top, a little piece of cotton which you lighted. And then, I'm not sure whether you lit them or not, but anyway, you flung one of these things they brought up for the brave men to tackle tanks with. You run up to a tank and flung it at the tank and it exploded and went into flames.
Did you ever try them out?
Yes, we tried them out, and they used to work very well because inside them they had this phosphorus, which I had some very bad experiences with later on in the war, which I'll be mentioning. When they're exposed to light, they burn, and this in turn set the petrol on fire, and it was very effective. They were good things. Well, the least little knock used to set these bottles, break these bottles, so they were thin glass. Just normal glass bottle. And we had quite a number in the trench there, and I often wondered if they were ever destroyed or whatever happened to them. You know, just curiosity, as I passed Roundtree Road, I said I would like to probe in there to see if the ammunition is ever taken out.
What did you spend?
This is only one of the houses, man. There'd be hundreds and thousands of houses in the same way, but it's just my curiosity.
Now, this is into 1941 now, the winter of 40-41.
It was 1940. The back end of 1940, this is.
And moving into 41, what were you doing now? What was the battalion engaged in doing? Were you doing any large-scale training?
We weren't doing large-scale training at this stage, but everyone was doing weapon training to get to know their own weapons. Everyone was confined to the billet areas because of invasion imminence. And when September came on, after Cromwell, things started easing up a bit. We just got on with weapon training, drill, shine up raids, maybe teaching the men how to turn out smart and what have you. Anything to fill in the time. The battalion found plenty to do for me to do in my spare time. I don't know whether it was part of the punishment of what went on. But the Home Guard was now started up. This was shortly after Dunkirk, even when I was at Carnaby. I didn't have time to go down to Bridlington or any such place of that nature. I was shoved off to teach Home Guard and different weapons and take them on anything, on exercise, explain to them about war and get them to work. I didn't take them on drill. I didn't believe in drill at this stage. I thought it should be taught quickly how to use grenades, how to use rifles and Bren guns. And I used to take a lorry along with us with a 2-inch mortars on, with a 3-inch mortar on and with all the different weapons that they may be acquainted with later on. And I used to take them on this. I had one very serious sweat on once. I took one of the new 3-inch mortar bombs along with us. And I'm not being a hero. Somebody had to learn about them. We had these same things in France, but there had been no book of instruction, nor had we been told about it. When you take the fuse cap off, unlike the old one, where the first shock of the action was when the bomb hit the bottom of the barrel. This one, as soon as you took the cap off, the top sprung up as if it was ready for going off. Well, I was showing these lads the 3-inch mortar, and one of them took the safety cap off. Mind there was tape on, but this is farmers, this is lads. Took the top of them. I didn't know what to do, so I says, there was some big, massive trees there. I said, well, there's only one way to find out, and I went behind a tree, and I said, no, just stay where you are, and I screwed it on, and it didn't go off, fortunately. I should have, if I'd had any sense, I'd left it up, but I'd hate for me to take a 3-inch mortar bomb back to my battalion and tell them I didn't know what had gone wrong with it. So I had to find out there and then, so I screwed the back on, and then we all knew that you could put the top back on safely. The first action hadn't taken place, actually. So I used to take Home Guard all over the shop.
What sort of things did you do with them?
As I said, show them weapons, let them handle weapons, show them rifles, show them all sorts of ammunition, show them the types of grenades they had, were Molotov cocktails, because these lads had nothing. They were just coming along in the civvies with a civilian clothing, with an armband on.
Would they get the chance to fire any of them under your control? Or?
No, not at this stage, because we were still observing very close fire control. You had to do it on a proper range, or a 30-yard range. 30-yard ranges weren't invented them days. It had to be a proper range, a proper shoot. So I
you were giving lectures, in other words?
Giving lectures
and
all the
time. Showing
them? Handling. Showing them. Demonstration. Explanation, as we call it in the army. Practice. They knew they could do it. Well, we used to have rounds that they could put in the rifles and discharge, which I don't know how the battalion got them, but they had them. They could put them in and go through the action of firing the wooden fire. They were doing DP rounds, as they called them. And I used to go off night after night and take these people, great crowd of lads. They'd listen so intently to what you were saying without interruption.
What did you think? What backgrounds were they from? Were there First World War veterans amongst them, or what?
One or two. Some were just farmers. Some were young farmers, young farm people, old farm people, gamekeepers, all sorts. You mentioned that's in a country for a combine. Then you had it with these lads, and also keen and willing. And of course their best part was to sit down and talk about Dunkirk. And I wouldn't talk about Dunkirk to them until I was finished their training session. I'd give them a good 2 hours, and then after the 2 hours, I thought I'd had enough. It was now relaxation time. And we didn't go to pubs as so commonly thought. We used to sit in a green sward where we were, and I'd be standing talking to them, telling them about France, telling them about certain incidents, and this continued. So we built a happy camaraderie spirit between us.
So that would start in the summer of 40 if you were able
yes,
to sit outside.
It was.
And in the winter, would you go and would you still sit
no,
out?
No, well, we went back to as I said, to Bridlington itself. And I used to go off and take the Home Guard once again.
What did you think of, I mean, you said they were good lads and they were keen to learn. Do you think they would have formed any sort of efficient fighting force?
Well, the one unit I was concerned with, I'm sure they would. They were just no different to any communist gardener man that you receive in the army to teach him as a soldier. They may not pass the fitness test. They may have some reason for being a bit slower, but they were certainly made good soldiers. I was greatly impressed with them.
And what unit was this? Did it have a name?
I'd have to look at maps. I'd have to go back in, to find out the place. I know it was outside of Carnaby, and I also know there was a Roman Catholic convent just beside where we were, but the name of the place, just I couldn't remember it now.
Now, so you were kept busy on this throughout the summer of 40 and into the winter of 40?
Yes.
You were busy on the Home Guard. Anything else you were doing?
Not much, no. As a matter of fact, the army started taking a more lenient view. Winter was coming in, and they allowed us to have our families with them, so we all start looking for accommodation, lodgings, because Bridlington being such a place that catered for holidaymakers, it was easy to find accommodation for your wife to stay, so I had my wife staying with us. So we'd stay there until evening and then go back. But yes, there was a lot of exercise and everything went on. There'd be battalion exercise, marching, route marching, long route marching. I'll give you one little instance of what went on, just to give you an idea that one just went to seed. We were always at work. There was one night when I was at Bridlington. I'll go back to Carnaby again. This is a rather funny story people might like to hear. I was sent for one day by the agent. He says, I want you to go down to Bridlington tonight. You'll take charge of a platoon of Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I said, why not me own, sir? He says, never mind asking. I think it was Royal... No, you'll be given a platoon of men. He says, and you'll go to the police and you'll receive instructions from the police what to do and carry out them orders. He says, now the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the Royal Berks are going to block the roads off right around Carnaby because it appears that people are not taking notice of the curfew. This was after the bombing of Carnaby. Of Bridlington. That was another funny little story which I'll enlarge upon in a minute. Anyway, I got the job of going down to, it must have been about the same time, must have been when Bridlington, I had to go around to the police, and the same police that I met, the sergeant that I met on this shooting business, he was there. "Hello, Samager." He says, "We've got a funny job for you this time." He says, "We want you to enforce the curfew in Bridlin." And it's still a bit of a holiday place, and people are still there on holiday and what have you. He says, "Now, they're not taking notice of the 9:30 curfew where they've got to be off the streets." He says, "You've got to go up the streets on either side and the back lanes and everything with your men, with your bayonets, and everyone you find, you rope in and send them back to us. So if you walk up the streets that way in a V with your points up by the walls, the V like a funnel coming to the middle of the street, we'll be there waiting of all people you find." And we roped in a lot of people that way. And so we're done the main streets of Bridlington, and as soon as the people saw us, they cleared the streets, emptied. And then we went down some of the back lanes as the police directed us to, and we found young courting couples making love, and went to interrupt them and say, "Hey, in there." And it caused a lot of embarrassment with the lad and the lass. It's true, this. And the police took them all away. We heard no more about it, but after that, the people observed the curfew. But we had to enforce this curfew.
But before that story, you mentioned the bombing of Bridlington.
Yes. One day I was drilling the men in Carnaby, and we dismissed them, and they'd just gone to the houses. And I saw a German bomber come over. Well, just round the corner on Rowntree Road, turn left, at the bottom house on the end was our battalion headquarters. And I knew they had a double Bren gun there for ACAC defence. And I run down along the street and down this corner, and I shouted, "That's a German! That's a German! Shoot him!" I'd love to get behind the gun, but there's sentries on it, and they had the anti-gas capes, anti-gas warning things on and everything. And the men are loading the gun ready to fire when the plane is coming towards us. And the commanding officer comes out onto a veranda, like a fire escape of the house. He says, "Don't shoot! Hold your fire! Hold your fire!" I said, "It's German, sir! Hold your fire!" The plane circled round and dropped a bloody big bomb on Bridlington. Dropped 2 or 3 bombs on Bridlington. We might have hit it. We might not. We might have shoved him off mark. And he was so low, I don't think anybody could have missed him. He just circled round, come in, circled round, very low, about, I'd say, 300 feet off the ground. And he got away with it. Anyway, that was another little incident whereby recognition of aircraft was an important part of an infantryman's life. They must know the German and the, well, enemy aircraft. I knew them because I'd been involved with being bombed by them so much in France. And we also knew the dive bombers, but these were their Boeing, I'd forget the name of them, their special type of aircraft, something like our Blenheim. They were much mistaken. Blenheim and this other plane were much alike. But I knew it was a German, and he just bombed Bridlington.
And presumably your colonel hadn't recognised it.
Maybe he hadn't been out the house to look. He was frightened of me shooting down one of our own planes because Driffield Aerodrome was just near at hand. But I knew it was German. Anyway, we occupied the winter in a big way in sort of sandbagging houses, sandbagging important places, going down the beach. We were fully occupied. We were in bed one night. An order came, battalion prepare immediately to go and repel imminent invasion of Saltburn. Without any warning, everybody had dive out, me out, me lodgings, and harness up, and we set off marching. There was snow on the ground. We set off marching across the moors. Mine was some march that, and it was a forced march. And some of the men weren't as fit as they should be. And so we set off on this long march to Saltburn. It was about 60 miles. I don't know the distance. I've never measured it up. But it was a night and day march. We marched through the night, through the day. As a matter of fact, it was one of the few times I saw men marching asleep. They were so exhausted, because they hadn't received a lot of warning about it. And the only time you know a man's is asleep when he's walking, you follow each other, and then you take a bend in the road, he walks straight on and lands up in a ditch or something. And you hear the cursing and the blinding as he runs back into position. And of course, by then, other men have followed him, maybe in the same state. We marched onto Saltburn, where we got near Saltburn, and we prepared for a big attack.
Did everybody manage to keep up? Or did you have some people dropping out?
I wasn't interested in people dropping off. We had some very bad marches, my platoon. Very, very bad. And I used to get into trouble with it over and over again off Major Hamner. I told you before that the company's weeded out. They sent you not the best men, they sent you the worst. Not in all cases. They sent you men that couldn't march, men that was always on sick and things of that nature. And then you in turn had trouble with them, trying to make soldiers of them. And I couldn't weed them out anywhere else. I was stuck with them.
You said you had a mixture. You had some who volunteered to be with you and some who... So you had a...
That's him. I had the odds and sods. And they were the ones that used to drop out. And I used to get hell with the lid off. Once I was on an O group, the command officers knew started a new O group where they'd talk and plan movements of troops.
Hang on, we'll come to that. Sorry, I distracted you there. We'll stick to the story about Saltburn. What happened when you got there?
Well, everybody got ready for the big attack on Saltburn. And then once we'd reached there, they cancelled the exercise. Exercise achieved, you know. They'd reached there within the time. They're supposed to repel the invasion. But we'd walked for about 48 hours non-stop to get there. And that was in bad, bad weather. Snow on the ground.
Well, but what did happen to your transport?
We didn't have transport. We were infantry. We weren't mechanised. We were foot soldiers. There's no such thing as buses and things for troops. Them, you had to walk it. It was only later after this that we started getting buses for it to be a mobile role as a mobile defence for the brigade. We were the people who were in buses, rushed to any spot where there was a breakthrough.
I'll come to that as well. Now, you said that they were setting up an O group. Could you tell me about the establishment of O groups?
Well, the O group was company commanders, the signal officer, the mortar officer, and the MT officer, and the adjutants, and, of course, the quartermaster. This involved any movement of troops. If there was movement of troops in, the quartermaster was there. If not, then the quartermaster wasn't there. But all of the essential people regarding control of men, company commanders, signals officer, mortar officer, and different people were now taking over the job. And at one of these, I got rollicked right left and centre of Major Hamner, which had nothing to do with the O group thing, about my men falling out on parade, on the march. And you've got no comeback with an officer in front of officers like that. You can't argue the toss, you just stand and take it. And he upbraided me no end for the state of efficiency and fitness of my men. And it was just the same two men who were doing it all the time. And no way, they were noted for it throughout the battalion in peacetime. I knew them in peacetime. And because I marched on and left them, that was it. So order was that instead of platoon commanders, I got wrong for this. And all the other officers there, the cap was fitting just the same. In future, when you're on a route march, you'll not march at the front of your platoon, you'll march at the rear. And anyone that slacks behind, you'll kick them up the backside and make them get on. And I'm looking around at the officers, do the company commanders do that? Do all the platoon commanders do that? But I got slated good and proper over my misfits in my platoon at one of these O groups. It was about this time, just before the Saltburn do, I was drilling the men on Rontree Road. Again, everybody's now expecting a high standard of men on guards and sentries drills, a smarter turnout, a smarter saluting from the men to the officers who are now all living in houses in the area. And it was one time along there when an officer came up and stood beside us and stood beside us all morning. This was the approaches I didn't like in the army. Maybe it was my company commander. He was an old man. But this is, and the sergeant major that I spoke about, I forget the name of the company commander, but he was an oldish man. I knew he wouldn't go to war. A real old daddy of a man. He took the interest of the men at heart. And this officer came along, and I said, I halted the men, first of all, and saluted them. I said, sir, can I be of any help? He says, oh, no, just carry on. So I carried on with the drill, and he follows us in the billets. And he was following me around all night and day after that. No one told me that he is now going to command the platoon. He didn't tell us. No one told me at all. Now, I'm a platoon commander. This is the way they used to treat you. I was left on my own. I had no idea what it was. So one day I got home. I said, just what are you doing here, sir? He says, didn't you know that I'm taking over your platoon? I said, no. He was annoyed about it, that I hadn't been told. He says, that's why you're treating me off-handed. I said, yes. I said, because I thought you were just snooping.
What had happened to Rudd?
Rudd had left us. After the shooting incident, I never saw any more of Rudd. I don't know what happened to him. Yes, I do. Sorry. Just a flash. He'd been trying hard to transfer at the Royal Engineers because he said he was a qualified engineer. And I think he'd had his fill of infantry in France. And he got his ambition. He was transferred to the Royal Engineers.
So you'd returned to the command of
your
platoon. And now this chap was it must have been 4 or 5 months later.
Yes, it was.
It was the winter.
He was called Lieutenant Clegg, brand new officer.
Clegg.
I think it was Clear. Lieutenant Clear. And he turned out to be such a smashing officer. He was another daddy. Daddy, we call him men. I call them daddies if they look after men. Men are the forefront of comfort. If a man gives his best, he's got to be looked after. And he turned out to be a good mortar platoon commander. And then he became adjutant of the battalion. He was adjutant in the battalion when I went out wounded. And he was surprised when he saw us going out wounded. I saw the surprise in his face. But from there on...
Were you able to form a good relationship with him? A working relationship?
Yes. But I was a bit reluctant about officers at all. I explained I had a reluctance about officers after France. And the dealings that had been given me about the shooting and their methods of sending someone to take over from you. If I have anyone to take over, if I had a corporal that wasn't satisfactory to me and I want to replace him with another corporal or shift him, I'd go up and tell him. I wouldn't beat about the bush. And the same with the sergeant. I'd say, here, sergeant, you're not pulling your weight in this company. Now, I'm changing you. You're going out, I'm putting somebody in your place. You'll do section commander as compared to platoon commander. I'd be forthright with them. But I don't know, there was a devious way of going on. I don't know whether they were just dealing with me and their method for me punishment for what I'd done at Hamilton Hill. But that is what happened, and I had little time for officers for many, many years.
How did this second batch of officers match up to your first batch? Because the first batch of officers you'd had, you weren't too satisfied, as you said, with the way some of them behaved. I mean, you haven't been global about it. You're not saying no. They were all bad, and I've noted that. But this second batch, you seem, in a sense, to have disliked even more for the way they treated you. Is that right?
Let's get that true. The new batch of officers, to me, were very good officers. They were national servicemen who'd been picked out and earmarked for to make potential officers from their squad or their group that were in with. And the selection people weren't very far wrong. They made good officers, good soldiers, and having been infantrymen from the start, had the interest of the men at heart. Oh no, I thought the new officers, which were stemming mainly from the national service element, men called up, now becoming officers, I thought were good.
What about the colonel and Hanmer and that? You don't seem...
Well, the colonel and I got on great. He was, as a matter of fact, I'm quite sure that it was him who had a lot of dealings with preventing any further harassment of me.
I'll amplify that later on
as we move from Bridlington to near Malton.
Did he have a big influence on the battalion, do you think?
He had a great influence because he was a machine gun officer in the First World War and he had the MC and people thought a lot of him. But he was a sick man. Well, I could see it. I knew him from his depot days and I could see him. He just didn't look the fit man he should have been. Not the commander of battalion.
Was he sick when he arrived?
Yes, he was sick when he arrived.
So it wouldn't be... Was it overwork that made it work?
I'll tell you what it was eventually. He had cancer. We didn't know it. He knew it, and he died of it. He died much later on when we went to a place called Rillington back by Malton. But I'll conclude about
that's fine.
Rillington.
What about the other officers? When you went into winter billets at Bridlington, had you had many of the new National Service officers coming in then, or were you still with dugouts?
No, we were in billets, in houses, we're sleeping in houses.
No, I mean, were you with the officers?
I see.
Dugouts. Sorry, that's confusing.
The officers, as I told you, came from the National Service men.
Already by then?
And the regular officers now commanded either the battalion or second in command of the battalion or were company commanders. All the platoon commanders were young people who'd either been on reserve or been on supplementary reserve, you know, which is a thing which is that they're not active service hostilities only. And there was these people who were coming in from the National Service Element, now promoted through their training colleges. Found them very well indeed, very good. They'd listen to you. If they'd come to Lakes of Mean, ask for advice or talk about what you do there, Sam, if they've got a Barbary man or somebody not pulling his weight, they'd ask you. I said, no bother at all, says, stick him in the jug. You know, tell them the truth about what you thought of them. Not let any man take advantage of them. That was the main thing, but they're good fellows.
How did the division of responsibility lie between, for instance, you, the platoon officer and you, a platoon sergeant major? You said they were getting rare PSMs, yes. But who was it, you know, who was in charge of what at this stage?
That was very easily defined, as per the rule book. I now took on the role, although I had a platoon sergeant, I took on the role of platoon sergeant, responsible for drill, discipline, turnout, and accommodation and feeding of the men. And the officer took over command, overall command. That was, he didn't know anything about a 3-inch mortar. And for a long, long time, I didn't know he was even, as I said, taking over command. Or else I might have taken him away and given blackboard lectures. I could have given him blackboard lectures on what the 3-inch mortar could do on safety and the shoot and describe the gun and everything to him. I didn't get this opportunity because they didn't tell me. But we got on great. He used to come along each morning, I'd salute him, call the men to attention, salute them. Will I carry on, sir? You carry on, sir, Major. And he'd stand and watch us on 3-inch mortar drill on Rontree Road or on the golf green or on the links where we went for to do some, you know, undercover shooting practice on actual ground. And he'd be there all the time watching us.
So he was sort of a supervisory role at this time?
Well, he was taking the same role as any officer should be, watching these training of his men and seeing that things were going all right. Yes, supervisory role.
Did they provide a leadership at the time?
Leadership courses?
No, were they also the sort of leaders, the inspirational leaders in training, or were they just really watching?
Well, they were out of depth at that moment. It was only by maybe a year or two experience with the battalion that they start being, as officers should, they knew their role then. They had to learn the gradual method. They may have learnt the theoretical method at the place where they've been, octuos, but now they had to learn the practical method. There's a difference between the theoretical and the application of the practical thing on the ground. And they became, in no time, by experience, officers. Their company commanders would pull them up if they'd done wrong. Their sergeant majors would advise them if they'd done wrong. And the platoon sergeant, maybe persons who had a lot of service in, maybe India, but not so many from France. They'd advise him, sir, you want to get a hold of that man, he's too liberal with you. And so they learnt in that manner by experience.
How did you get on with the civilians in Carnaby and Bridlington? And how much did you mix with them? You've mentioned about in the pub, where they'd buy you drinks when you first got there from Dunkirk. But did that carry on after the novelty value had worn off?
The people were very friendly, but I had so little dealings with them, I didn't go out so much. I was living in the shell. I've explained the reason why I'm in the shell. I was depressed. I was a bit shell-shocked. I was depressed about the shooting business, and I just lived in a shell. But people used to speak to us. There was some people at the farm called Marshall, and he was an agricultural merchant, and he had big thresh machines and weed binders, and he used to go out cutting harvests. And his wife said, well, why don't you bring her up and stop with us for a while? I brought her up. And this is the type of people who are. They became very friendly, but I was involved with my day training, my home guard training. I used to be with them not so much, but when I could, I was with her. And they say, if I had any time off, do you fancy coming up the fields? We're threshing the day, and we'd go up the field, and they'd let me drive one of the tractors. On the threshing business, I was a highly qualified driver, but anyway, and would help on the farm threshing and do things of this nature. There was one incident whereby a bloke come across to me and says, watch yourself, there's four aerial bombs on the ground there. There had been an attack on Bridlington, and the person had let go of the bombs, and they'd landed in a field not far away. And I went and had a look at them, and you could look down this long hole, and see the tail fins of the bombs down below. And there weren't of any danger. If they had to go off, they would have gone off on the percussion at the ground. He said it was safe enough, but just to keep clear of there with the tractors. And I told the people about it, and they kept clear. And I often wondered if them bombs are still there or not. The people were very sociable.
How did the ordinary soldiers get on? Was there any friction in the town over women or anything?
There's too much friendliness. The lads were talking about getting married now. And they had friends that were inviting them to their houses for meals, and church. They were going to different places where they're getting free parties. They were having a wheel of a time, the lads. They were lapping it up.
Was there any trouble with the local lads, though?
None at all. None.